And it wasn't because I was rebelling against Christianity. I was learning things and realizing I can't unsee what I've seen. I can't pretend to not know this about the Bible.
Hello and happy new year to you. Gary here. Got another episode for you. Actually, it's part one of a two-part episode with a longtime friend of mine named Ryan Meeks from Eastlake Church near the Seattle area. And let me go ahead and frame this for you. So our tagline is elevating voices who are reimagining faith. Now, Ryan is the perfect candidate for this because Ryan is the type of human, the type of pastor, leader, who is constantly asking questions, constantly reimagining faith, church, what it means to be a spiritually connected person, like so much. And so I am so excited about this series of episodes because Ryan is somebody who was a rising star in the mega evangelical world, as you'll get to hear a little bit of his story in the episode. I've been featured in Seattle Magazine as one of the most influential people in Seattle. And then the thing that really caught wind just a few years ago was when he was featured in Time for an article regarding the inclusion of the LGBTQ community. And Ryan was one of the first large evangelical churches to make a shift from being not affirming to affirming. And so there's a wild story involved with that, but all of that points to the fact that Ryan is someone who continually evolves and changes. And so I think in this episode, you are going to be challenged. You're going to hear some new ideas. I think you might feel freed in some ways. You'll feel provoked in some ways, and you'll probably hear things that you disagree with and maybe you don't like along the way. And here's the beauty. You don't have to agree with everything. That's not the whole deal. Like, if this just provokes you to think for yourself, to engage faith in a more meaningful way, that's the goal. So I think you'll walk away finding these episodes very valuable. And what I'd ask of you is maybe shut off that part of your brain that when you're introduced to content that you haven't heard before or that doesn't line up with your worldview or the way that you were taught about the Christian faith, the Bible, God, Jesus, all of that, that maybe you could just open yourself up, listen, and allow this conversation to potentially shape you moving forward in how you approach your spirituality. So with that, let's launch into part one with Ryan Meeks. And maybe I should say one of the most beautiful things that you're going to hear is about a community willing to let go of control and certainty, and ultimately, the way that Ryan says it, come to a place where you recognize that life is a gift and love is the point. Here's part one with Ryan Meeks. Ryan Meeks is here from Eastlake Church. Ryan, how you doing, man?
Good to be here, Gary, in my own house.
In your own, yeah.
Thanks for bringing me on.
I know. In our studio called The Meeks Home. So I'm pumped to have Ryan on here for you listeners to be able to hear his story because really, Ryan is one of those guys that I think what the frame to put this conversation is, it's the evolution of a church and a leader who is constantly evolving, changing, progressing, being open to wherever that journey takes him and his faith community. So, Ryan, I mean, let's go back. Let's go back when I worked for you, when I started going to your church way back in the day, like, was that 2004, I think.
Probably. Last time I moved, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, tell us, you know, you started this community and give us the story behind that.
Yeah, well, I mean, the flyover would be I was, married with very little kids in San Diego. I was working as the creative director at my dad's evangelical church in the San Diego area, but always kind of knew I'd come back. This is where I had done most of my growing up, and kept feeling like every time I'd come back to visit, like none of my friends really connected to any sort of a spiritual community, and I wouldn't have either. Nothing, everything was sort of like, oh, what, you're under 40? Your gathering takes place in the fellowship hall on Thursday nights at 8:07, you know? It's always like a sub-ministry of, you know, whatever large church. So, at a certain point, my wife and I were just both like, I think it's time. Let's go try something. Let's throw something against the wall and see if we might create a church for folks like us, where we could go on a journey, where we could change and evolve, and where we could do it our own way. And that's sort of the beginning of it. It was super evangelical at the beginning. I mean, that's where I came from. That was the world I understood. It was the world that had given me so much. And I don't mean anything just beyond like belonging and a worldview that helped me engage the world in a redemptive way. I think I don't have a lot of, I mean, I'm sure we're going to talk a lot about a lot of things that I don't like about evangelicalism in this podcast, but I think it's important to start by saying I'm grateful for what I came up in and through. And, you know, regardless of, you know, all the things, the misgivings I have with it today, it formed me and shaped me. It gave me something to reject, which is part of growing up. And so I'm grateful for that. So we moved up in 2004 and launched publicly in 2005. And I think that's about when I met you. It was either the end of 2004 or
end of 2004. I started coming December.
Because you only came to the school, not to the performance center, right?
Yep. Came to the school.
Okay. So it was the junior high. Yeah. And so we launched publicly Easter 2005. With about 200 people, and we've been doing practice services up until then, not going great. It was like 150 to 130 to 75 to 62. I think at one point I was like, "All right, well, I'll be moving back to San Diego shortly."
Dad, you still got a job open down there? Yeah.
Well, I just had so much practice teaching sermons, you know, meaning I had zero. So I'm not surprised it shrunk quickly.
But, how old are you at this time? I mean,
let's see. I'm 39 now. So what would I be, 26 at that point?
26 starting this church. Like, I mean, that's kind of crazy.
It was crazy. It was scary for sure. But also I was so naive that I kind of just, I think we had a lot of like blind faith in ourselves. That it was just, you know, my wife and I and seven friends who were kind of doing everything at the beginning. And it was great. I think a lot of what made it work at the beginning was our naivete, our energy as 20-somethings.
Yeah.
And that we actually, you know, had fun. And there was something about showing up to something that was ground floor, that it was being shaped in real time. And we have always been irreverent and goofy and fun.
Yeah. Okay. So I think one of the fascinating things, even for me, since I was a part of the church at the very beginning, getting to see this, like, you know, I think I came around when it was that like 50-ish people were kind of showing up.
For sure. Yeah.
And then pretty quickly, there's like this massive group of people that are coming. So you go from like little church plant to becoming essentially like this evangelical kind of mega pastor guy, invite all the conferences, you know, everybody wants you to speak. And so, I mean, tell us a little bit about like the journey to get you to that point where you're like the guy who is, people are looking to for, here's how you do church.
Yeah. So we launched publicly in 2005 with about 200 and, gosh, we were upstairs in the junior high, as you remember, in the cafetorium. And, I mean, I don't know how to say it. We just kind of were doing something. It was a church being led by 20-somethings, and that wasn't anywhere around us. So I think in that way, it was a novelty, and there was no quote-unquote competition for that. You were remotely interested in going to a church, and you didn't want to go to a boomer church, we were kind of one of the few options that were around.
You're it.
And it was blowing and going. I mean, pretty quickly we were over 200, and then we were over 600 by the next year. And then I think by 2007, we were running about 1,400 and realized we're too big for this junior high. People were getting towed every week from parking illegally. And so we ended up, like, I was terrified, but we bit off a lease that I thought was way too big for us. But in 2008, we moved into Bothell into that warehouse. It was like a 70,000 square foot warehouse. And overnight, we were running 2,500 to 3,000.
Yep.
And then quickly, it was, you know, 3,000, 3,500, 4,000. And then we'd get to the point where, you know, we would have Easters of 8,000 and things like that. But we never were running regularly over 4,000.
Okay.
I've heard big numbers before, but that's not really, our size was never really more on regular than 4,000.
Yeah. So through that season, I mean, are you just eating it up like, oh, this is it? Like, this is the way to do it? I mean, are you just totally bought in?
I think for a while, you know, it was really fun and exciting, and we, you know, we were having a lot of good times and enjoying a lot of success. Everything had been up and to the right for us for a long, long time. However, when we got into the building, the warehouse in 2008, I still had a staff of like four or five.
Yeah. At the point. There weren't many of us.
And they were like, yeah. And yeah, you're right. You were one of them.
Yeah.
At that point,
it was
and
crazy.
So we moved in, and it was, I basically spent 2008 to 2010 building a staff so that I could do less than everything else that, mm-hmm. you know, I think we've talked about this before. Like, you know, when you get sent out by the evangelical church planting machines, you really get given a playbook. Like, this is what yep. you do. This is how you do it. And of course, there are different branding companies that kind of do that. And we came from the church growth movement, evangelicalism thing. And in many ways, like, it's not quite as important, the sermons. It's like all the systems and all the rest of it. And
yeah.
so we were doing a great job at that. And then I think in 2000, you know, 2008, 2009, I started reading all the books I was told I wasn't supposed to read.
Uh-oh.
Because I had time. You know, I could finally start to ask some questions of my own. And I had read some Brian McLaren stuff.
Well, okay, so how did you yeah. even, I mean, what even inspired you to say, I'm going to grab that book? Or, I mean, how do we even order books back then? Was Amazon a thing?
Yeah,
I don't
yeah.
even know.
Yeah, I think I did order them on Amazon at that point.
Yeah, because something had to be going on to make you even go, I'm going to, these, McLaren, look out. Right?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, working in evangelical megachurch, I guess you can go one of two ways. You can smoke what you're selling, or you can start to go, is this really, what are we actually accomplishing here?
Okay.
You know, any rapidly growing mega church is growing mostly by people who marginally attend elsewhere or regularly attend elsewhere.
Yeah.
Christianity is on a nosedive around the world in general. It's specifically in areas where education is on the rise. And so you see
okay.
Christianity growing in places where education is not really available to a lot of people, which, you know, you kind of think, you're going to have some hard questions about that. Either
yeah.
education is a tool of the devil, or there's something about the way we express our Christianity in the world that needs people to stay ignorant. Right?
Mm.
I don't think
wow.
the yeah. Jesus path is the problem. It's what we've articulated as Christian theology that is actually the problem. So I just started having questions. I mean, I'm dealing with real people every day. And I'm like, is that really true? You know, and so some misgiving. So I started to sort of silently and secretly read to maybe even I would fool myself into thinking, well, at least I'll understand that evil emergent church so I can denounce it with my, you know,
yeah,
my correct doctrine. Of course, Marcel was on the rise at that point.
Yeah,
were,
right here.
The biggest thing going on in Seattle. And I mean, I'd have visitors from Marcel constantly who would, you know, corner me at the end of a service with their Bibles and try to correct my non-Calvinistic theology. So it was just a different time.
Yeah,
than it
okay.
even is today. So anyway, that's why I read those books. That started to kick me off in a direction where not only did I have time to consider questions I had pushed deep down into my soul,
yeah,
because I was too busy with a fast-growing church, and now with the staff, I could, you know, start thinking on my own. And, you know, that was the beginning of the slippery slope for me, was asking questions and reading books I shouldn't have read and things of that nature. And as you and I have talked privately before, it was probably between 2010 and 2012 where I felt myself begin to disintegrate. And I say it that way because my internal reality, who I was, how I was changing, how I was evolving, what my spirituality looked like, began to separate from what I was saying, doing, teaching on the weekends. And that's why it's never surprised me when I hear about these pastors who, like, you know, get exposed for, like, doing meth and having sex with somebody 20 years younger than them. I shouldn't laugh, but it's like there's this expectation and this pedestal people put pastors on, and they're not allowed to be on a journey. And so they,
okay,
whatever journey they go on, positive or negative, thankfully mine was, in my view, positive, they start to live a double life. Mine was theological, but I, you know, we see all the time where they're, people are having relational or sexual double lives and things like that. And it, things just continued to unravel and unravel for me until I got to a point where I realized it started to have a take a toll on my physical health. I had adrenal failure. I knew I needed to change my pace. So a lot of things were happening at the same time. We've been having lots of long talks as a staff about the LGBT conversation because we had plenty of people in our church. We were baptizing partnered lesbian couples and you know, we had gay guys in groups who were dating. And so the question would come up, and I, with everything in me, I just didn't want to deal with it because I thought there was only really one answer I was allowed to give. And I was like, it's just a shitty answer.
Yeah.
It's not life-giving. It's judgmental. What is the big problem God, quote unquote, has with these people? And so I just tried to avoid it by ignoring. And eventually, as you know, that didn't work long term.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're going on this journey behind the scenes. I mean, who are you talking to? Because it seems like a lot of times if somebody's on a journey, they need a sage or like a guide. So who are you talking to that's kind of like propelling you or even maybe giving you permission to continue to keep moving in that way? Like, can you remember any specific conversations that are like those marker moments of, oh, I remember talking to this person or.
At that stage? No, okay. Not many.
Really?
Because I was so embedded in the evangelical world that I couldn't trust people. Mm. I couldn't trust my honesty with people. I could trust my staff. And they were well aware. None of this journey is a secret to them. Which led to, I know, I remember stressing my staff out a lot of times with what I would bring to them and questions I would ask with them. Like, oh gosh, this guy is, you know, he's losing it or whatever.
Yeah, they're like, what is happening?
He's venturing into the land that we're not allowed to go to, that kind of stuff. But early on, the sages that I was looking to, you know, travel paths I had not yet heard of were through books. So I'd read one book and then I'd read all their footnotes and I'd be like, oh, okay, well, I'll read more about that. And that would take me here and here and here and here. And pretty soon I was opened up to a wealth of Christian history that I didn't even know was real. Evangelicals, maybe this isn't true for some evangelicals, but my story is we were sold that this was the true Christianity, which every tradition thinks they're true Christianity.
Yeah.
But I realized that evangelicalism is like such a tiny sliver of what passes for Christianity on globally. And then when you take history into account, evangelical theology is not only new, it's, you know, a tiny slice of the whole pie. So, yeah, not a lot of actual human beings talking to me. It was more of secretly reading.
Yeah. So that's 2010 to 2012. Yeah. Some of that's happening. So then, like, your story is this story of some pretty big shifts. So a lot of the shift is happening just internally. Mm-hmm. So then at some point you decide, we're going to make this a community shift. So what, tell us like kind of what got you to that place to say, let's go for it. And then what even, what you did and what happened.
Yeah. You know, and I'll even say, I've never talked about this publicly. I think multi-site was a part of it. And so in,
okay,
I can't remember what year it was, somewhere between 10 and 12, we had been out of space for a long time and we didn't own that facility. We had leased it. and we knew we were never going to buy a $32 million compound. You know, it's not going to happen. So we're like, what are we going to do? And I remember thinking, like, what if we strategically kill the church over the next 5 years and spread it out? We'd already planted a lot of churches around the country. What if we did it locally? And I looked for some models, and it was a failure everywhere, that strategy. I didn't want to raise a bunch of money to build our own campus. That sounded like hell to me too. So I thought about moving to San Francisco to plant a brand new church and just like give the church to somebody else and be like, cause I like the start. I like the, that side. And I remember my favorite thing was 600 people upstairs at the junior high. I could know everybody, but it was big enough to have resources and to do good quality stuff.
Yep.
But the bigger it got, the less I liked it. I was wondering, am I cut out for mega church pastoring? I don't know. It started to just drain and exhaust me. People treat you like you're either superhuman or super evil. You know, you're either Jesus Christ incarnate or Satan, you know?
And
that whole inability to be a human being sort of wore on me. But when we went multi-site, instead of just adding sites, we sort of tried to kill the main site by filming from the new location in Seattle, and then we tried Hologram, which was a massive failure.
What an massive
failure. But it was a cool technology. And then we started, I've been to Life Church, which I think is the largest church in American history still to this point. You know, which all these campuses, lifechurch.tv. And they were filming some talks while I was there, and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I could bring in anybody and have them film a talk on a Tuesday. They don't have to be gone on a weekend. Like, I was thinking about the possibilities.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think so much was happening in me that going multi-site and doing video, and this is the part I haven't shared because it's only recently come to my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think I needed the space that gave me from the church to not just quit.
Okay.
I was experiencing so much internal change and so much dissonance. And in fact, a lot of the doubts and questions I had were making me think that at the end of the day, I'm on a road to, you know, atheism.
Yeah.
And I was scared to talk to my wife about it. I thought I would lose my wife. I thought I would lose my family. I would lose my job, my tribe, the staff. You know, I mean, I was like, literally, everything was on the line. Like, I was going to be left alone. And it wasn't because I was rebelling against Christianity. I was learning things and realizing I can't unsee what I've seen. I can't pretend to not know this about the Bible. And yet to say it would anger people or whatever else. So anyway, what I'm saying is the space that pre-filming gave me to sort of disappear a little bit, even though it hurt the church a little bit, we hadn't started declining yet, but we sort of leveled off or barely grew for a little while.
Yeah.
But it gave me space to process. Otherwise, I think if I'd been in one location, still a huge church, actually physically there, it would have exhausted me to the point where I just would have quit. But it gave me the energy to keep going. And then at the end of 2012, I mean, I think that was about the time I just said, I just have to start teaching this stuff because I think it's liberating. Yeah. And I was feeling the liberation of it. And I was starting to share with my wife, and I realized that it was making it difficult in our marriage, but it wasn't going to kill it. You know, we were working on it together, and I had had some experiences traveling globally with organizations that we'd given tons of money to and to see their work around the world. And those experiences had opened me and made me realize Christianity and even spirituality was just so much wider. So courage, 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 right? I started to feel like, okay, maybe I can take another step. Maybe I can keep going. And, so basically 2013 and 2014 were major years of me trying to make the church take three steps when I was 20 ahead at that point. Like, I'm like, okay, can I move them even this much? Can I help them see the Bible differently? What does the word God even mean? And so even looking at the gospel and the teaching the Beatitudes in a different way was like stirring the pot a little bit. And I started to agitate this big, successful multi-site mega church. And we started to lose some people, which I thought was, oh my God, like this is it. Little did I know, it was nothing to the Niagara Falls of 2015. Now, 2014 was about contemplative spirituality. I think I did like a 15-week series. It's still a joke on our staff. Ancient Future Faith, the series that never ends. And I think I did 4 weeks on contemplative spirituality and meditation and how Eastern spirituality enhances
the Jesus path and how you know, hand in glove they are, really. Is that even a phrase? I think I just made butchered two phrases. But yeah. Anyway, there's that. And then, as you know, at the end of 2014 was when I did a No Filter series, which was about confronting the violence of the Old Testament.
Yep.
And I dared to suggest that the God that Jesus points to is not a God who ever commands genocide. And that until we come to grips with the evilness of that God that we all want to worship. Oh, he said, kill all the women and infants. Praise God. You know,
crazy.
That we're not going to have it, that faith that's just or generous or even beautiful. And that made a lot of people angry. I mean, I remember that was the most hate mail I'd ever gotten. And I'd been getting hate mail since 2005. We had always been told we were doing it wrong. We were evil. Like, that was not new to me. But No Filter was like, I thought things were sort of, you know, starting to deteriorate in 13 and even throughout 14. But at the end of 14, when I was doing that, I realized, like, okay, here we go. Now we're dealing with the real God of evangelical theology. And that's two things, hell and the Bible. That's the king and queen of evangelicalism, hell and the Bible. Hell is the God who controls everything.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Well, all the evangelical anxiety about getting your theology right comes down to hell. Like, why does it matter that you believe the right theology? Hell, that's why. You know what I mean? Everything comes down to hell. It's like, well, why their views on LGBT? Why do you get so worked up about them? Because they're going to go to hell. It always comes down to, at the end of the day, hell. And so even the way that they make the bullshit gospel of, like, God should kill you, but Jesus is like, well, wait, you know, and don't send them to hell, that whole thing. And like, well, how is that beautiful? Well, God's righteous and, you know, he wishes everyone could go to heaven, but his hands are tied somehow. You know, it's not like he's got, okay, well, it is God, but. And so what they're saying is it's like that whole C.S. Lewis weirdness where it's like there's the deep magic. Remember, the table breaks under Aslan because the deep magic.
Yeah.
So again, I think this is bullshit theology, but the idea that God's hands somehow are tied because he has to send people to hell. So this all-powerful God is in charge of everything. There's a God above him called the deep magic, according to C.S. Lewis, or it's called, hell.
Yeah.
There's this fundamental rule, this universal constant that God can't violate. That's just illogical to me.
Yeah.
So anyway, those are the gods. And I began clashing with the gods of evangelicalism, the Bible that is to be worshipped, a specific substitutionary atonement theology that is the centerpiece. It's like if Jesus' blood doesn't cover our sins for the God who needs a blood sacrifice, then there's no Christianity basically for evangelicals. It's like, well, if Jesus didn't, you know, save us by dying in our place substitutionarily, then you're not Christian. Mm. Those are the things we were clashing up against. And we had already been planning to talk about the LGBT conversation. But it was around the time when I was doing the No Filter series that our friend Christina, who was on our staff and leading music at the Seattle campus, came out and said, hey, I've fallen in love with our mutual friend, Ayla. Mm. She's weeping and crying, thinking it's going to be her last day. And that was like the straw that broke the camel's back. I mean, it was just like my whole life just exploded in my face. And I was like, I have been cowardly avoiding something that my heart changed on so long ago.
Yeah.
But I was already had gone through so many things of fearing losing everything that I thought LGBT, I can't even touch that one.
Yeah.
And when I realized that it had kept a friend in fear was when I realized, okay, it's time to make that. So we started planning and, you know, the quick story is Time Magazine ended up calling me because a friend of mine was like, you should talk to Ryan. He's going to be doing something soon. And that was either the greatest thing or the worst thing. But the Time article came out earlier than it was planned. And so like a week before I planned my talk, they ran the article. It was like, it may have even been 2 weeks. I don't remember. But so then it was just like, boom, the most angry. I mean, I was getting death threats and crazy shit. People were yelling at me at gas stations, like, screaming. It was crazy.
No kidding.
That all blew up, and then I had to get up and talk. Now, thankfully, I was still video back then, but I recorded a talk and said, here's where I'm at. You don't have to agree to stay.
But I'm not going to be your sort of hired sheriff who, you know, a lot of people, evangelicals, they're not going around marching against gay weddings. They're never even asked to officiate them in general.
Yeah.
But they wanted to make sure they went to a church where their pastor would say no to people. And I was basically getting up there saying, look, I don't want to have a church where everybody has to necessarily agree. That's impossible. One, you just have to pretend that everyone agrees. And it's not helpful. I don't think it's redemptive anyway. But just so you know, I'm no longer going to be your hired tell gay people they're a problem guy. That's not going to be, I'm not doing it.
Sounds like a life-giving career, right?
Yeah, it's the worst. So, you know, that upset thousands of people. And what I thought was, a couple people are leaving 2014, was just a waterfall. Thousands of people left over the next few months. And our budget dropped by, you know, when you look at what dropped is over the next year, we lost $2.8 million of our budget. So I thought for sure it was over at that point.
Well, okay. So I want to go back a little bit.
Yeah,
so
sure.
Even as you talked about before with you and your wife, Michelle,
yeah,
you know, you're starting to even talk to her about it. So you start considering and talking about meditation, contemplative spirituality. Mm-hmm. Then you go into confronting some of the text, right? Mm-hmm. The Bible. Mm-hmm. So as you're talking to her thrill, I mean, what is that like? Are you guys on the journey together this whole time? Are you guys tracking? Give us a little picture of kind of what's happening within your family system at this point. And even with your kids too. I mean, this has got to be massive stuff.
Well, my little boys still aren't really paying much attention
to
that stuff. So that never hit them. My older kids were preteen and teen at that point. So definitely. And my kids got a lot of bullshit throughout this. I mean,
I bet
garbage people would throw it at my kids for sure. That was a hard season. But for Michelle and I, you know, at first it was definitely me alone. And then it was me starting to tell her, hey, this is what's going on in me. This no longer works for me. It doesn't make sense. It's untenable. It's unreasonable theology to me. And I can't pretend that I believe it anymore. I don't. And that was hard. And I remember it being hard for her. And I was like, just so you know, I'm committed to you. Mm. I don't need a book to tell me to be faithful to you. Like, I want to be faithful to you because I love you. And I think that was a big part of helping us kind of move through that. Like, okay, I'm not like, I remember growing up in evangelical youth group, it was like atheists were like, you know, baby eaters, you know, or whatever. Just like evil.
They're just so horrible.
Insane. Yeah. Yeah. It turns out they actually get divorced less than Christians. But, you know, calming that whole thing down to look, these are mental theological categories. I'm not abandoning our family and I'm not turning into some sort of crazy hedonist drug addict. I just can't agree. I can no longer agree to propositional truth claims that insult my soul and hurt people.
Yeah.
I don't think they're life giving. And, thankfully we've always had such a strong relationship and a good marriage that she heard me out and we went slow. The truth is she was way faster than me when it came to the LGBT thing. She's
really
so relationally, just good with people and she leans relational. She's a 2 on the Enneagram and I'm a 7. So I'm always stuck in the headspace. I'm like constantly, you know, running anxiety loops in my mind. And I always think I can think my way into anything or out of anything or read my way into understanding or enlightenment.
Yeah.
And she relates her way there.
Okay.
And so she was quicker to be at peace with LGBT inclusion than I was. For some reason, I felt like I needed the Bible. I needed to twist the Bible to say it's okay. And I know there's a lot of people out there, people that I care about, like Matthew Vines, who's done a great job of trying to show how the Bible is not anti-same-sex relationships. I don't know that I share that opinion. I think I'm okay with saying the Bible. I used to like really want to make sure the Bible said, you know, had some sort of ethic from front to back on like inclusion of the LGBT community. I don't know. I'm pretty comfortable saying Paul didn't want women to teach and he didn't want people to, you know, be in same-sex relationships. And I've certainly, the relational side kicked in for me when Christina came out to us, obviously. And actually, to today, Michelle's way ahead of my journey. Like, she challenges me
Really?
Consistently. Actually, a lot of the ladies on our staff, I think in many ways, have pulled me much further ahead than I would have been without them.
Wow.
They're into stuff I'm like, I don't know if I'd buy that crap, you know?
Wait, what's an example?
Energy stuff where they're talking about energy. And a year ago, I was just like, girls, I don't need a new religion. I left one a while ago, you know? I don't need your new. And the problem is I've since had incredible experiences of energy movement in my own healing and therapy over the last few years, dealing with betrayal and abandonment and some of my own garbage. Like, I try to do a better job these days because, you know, it's not a hero story. Like, you know, like being an evangelical megachurch pastor, I don't know how you do that without hurting people. Cause I did. I know I hurt people. When you buy into a theology of up and to the right, we gotta save the world for Jesus because he's somehow waiting for us to do it, even though he's God. Yeah. It's crazy. Hope you do it because if you don't, I have to send him to hell because my hands are tied.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. No
I mean,
control
I had
here.
So much anxiety. I would wake up crying about the loss and like God said, send him to hell. And I love my friends who aren't Christians. And eventually I woke up just realizing like one day, like, why that doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that I am the burden's on me and they're going to die for thinking differently. And especially in my global travels, like why these people grew up a different religion. I happen to be Christian. What a shock. A white American male decides Christianity's the way. Like,
yeah.
I just had a lot of misgivings about that, but, yeah, the girls have been kind of ahead of me for a while now and that kind of stuff. So yeah. We'll see, but they've certainly shown me that they've been on the right track and, they've certainly pulled me in different directions, but. So I think one of the learnings to just speak to that is in a relationship, in a marriage, I guess, let me be more specific. It's amazing to me anyone stays married over decades if they're growing. No one grows at the same rate at the same time, meaning they don't start their journeys at the same time. So they don't start at the same time. They don't move at the same pace. And they don't head in the same direction exactly.
Yeah.
And so all three of those dynamics are happening disjointed. And so you have two people who are trying to cultivate a life together, starting at different times, going at different speeds, and heading in different directions. So I think the only way you stay, I think the only way you stay together for the long haul is you have to decide how much tension you can contain.
Okay.
And at some point, maybe you realize you're in such different places that you have to honor that this relationship is over. And there's no, it doesn't have to be animosity, but we've grown. I'm not who I was when I was 26 years old at Kirkland Junior High, starting an evangelical little church for 20-year-olds. I'm not that guy. I'm not the same guy who was an evangelical megachurch pastor in 2010. I'm not that guy. And yeah, I've been married to Michelle the whole time and before. And so we've had to learn how to allow one another to transform and evolve and change. And for us, we just have never hit the point where we were so far apart in our journeys where we had to end it. And thankfully, in many ways, we've caught up to one another on the journey. We've bumped in at some crossroads along the way. Or she's been way ahead of me on the next peak at some point. Like, what are you doing way over there?
Come join me. Yeah. It's great over here.
I know, and it looks scary to me. And there's a lot in the way. You know. So anyway, that metaphor has worked for us. And I think that's a big part of anytime people go through deconstruction of their worldview, especially if you have two people who are in the same worldview and then one person goes through a deconstruction, it's going to create a lot of tension. But if you don't have the if you don't have the space to let somebody go on their journey in that marriage, it's not going to make it. You know? I'm thankful that we did.
Yeah. Well, I think that speaks even so much to my own journey with Lindsay is that, I mean, a lot of it, I blame it on you, the journey. get that for the record.
Yeah, good.
but really, I mean, I think you were able to give me freedom in my own journey, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think I needed somebody to kind of propel me and say, like, come on, like, come and be on that. Cause I didn't grow up in church, you know, I was 20.
Yeah.
So I had all these things that whenever people tell me, I'd yeah. Why do you believe that? That sounds destructive.
Yeah.
But I would never really say much about it. I just was like, well, I guess since I'm a Christian by title, I have to buy into all these things.
Yeah.
And so then for Lindsay, growing up in a pretty traditional kind of conservative evangelicalism, for us, it we've been able to kind of stay on the same road, but we're definitely not in the same place. And like you said, it's kind of like a give and take. And
yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's one of the beautiful things about,
hey, Michelle.
Which show it is, by the way.
Michelle's back.
Here's Michelle.
Yeah, you're on the podcast. Say hello.
You want to say hi? I'm
so just back from hot yoga.
That's great.
I was just talking about you. You're great. You're great.
Don't worry
we'll
about
keep talking.
Hi.
No secrets here. Is that permission to go on your own journey?
Yeah, I think that's been so freeing that Lindsay's been in a place where she's like, yeah, go for it. Just keep reading. Because I think I'm similar to you in that way. Like, I do want to dive into that dark hole to find the truth. And
what Enneagram are you?
I'm a 3.
Okay.
Which is a little surprising because we tend to be the most disintegrated with.
Are you a 4 wing now?
Yep.
Okay. Well, there
you go. Yeah. So, yeah. So yeah, but I think that is one of those. Just to even hear you talk about, like, here's some of those learnings from that. Mm-hmm. It's huge. I'm going to pause here.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Voices Podcast. If you want to get the links for anything we talked about today, they will be in the show notes on patreon.com/voicespodcast. If you go there, you can scroll down to the episode and you will see all the links right there.
And if you're interested in becoming a supporter of the show, we are on Patreon. So you can go to our Patreon website and you'll see different levels of supporting the show. That helps us to get different guests on the show, put more time and resources to this. And one of the things we want to do is be a resource to you on your spiritual journey. That was the whole vision behind this in the first place. So one of those ways we do that is at different levels, there are different resources that we'll make available to you as you are working through reimagining faith.
We also want you to be able to join the conversation with us. So make sure you leave us a comment on Facebook or tweet at us on Twitter. We are Voices Podcast on Facebook and at Voices Pod on Twitter. Let us know what you thought, agreed with, disagreed with, and what you want to hear more about.
All right. Thanks for listening.